we were going to talk about LGBT this summer, and I thought we were going to talk about issues and things like that. And we are, except as I approach it, what I've realized is this. If we just go ahead and give you more rhetoric, more things to say, and more, you know, just ideas to throw over there and kind of like, and then they go and they go, oh yeah, and then they throw it over here. It's kind of that's kind of the way it is. And in the blogosphere, that's what you see, right? You see just a lot of that back and forth. Oh yeah, well I'm going to, you know, do this, and yeah, well you didn't think about that, and really, you know, the issue about how do we treat. Is that like a dish, satellite dish, or TV dish? Yeah, if I get close to here, and I'm doing one of my things, and just warn me, all right? Okay. Oh, my. Okay. He's a braver man than I am. But here's the thing. In reality, the question isn't how to counter arguments and things like that. That is important, but there's a lot of it out there. And so I feel like there's enough of it out there that we don't really have to go over things that are we can already read on our own out there. But how do I engage with my LGBT friend? Well, the answer really is the same way you would engage with your heterosexual friend. The same way you would engage with any friend. And that is to bring the fragrance, the power, the presence, the touch, the essence, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. And that's why I've been focusing on what I've been focusing on so far, because I think that is where we've been failing. And so, before we get to arguments and things, if the arguments don't have any working power, if the arguments are there, but then the person delivering the argument obviously doesn't believe in the argument, then really how effective and how good is that argument if it doesn't even change you, the deliverer of the argument, you know? And so I realize it goes way, way back. And so before we even talk about those things, we've got to come way back and examine the kind of Christianity that we are purveying. And if the kind of Christianity we're purveying is really just another brand of preference, like anybody else is branding out there, then all we are is we're just one sect or one flavor of a polytheistic culture, you know, which is great. I love polytheism. What's the word? Eunice? Pluralism. That's the word. Thank you. Pluralism. I knew she... That's the word I'm thinking. Oh, I said, polytheism. That's many gods. No, not that. A pluralism. I love it that I can live in Los Angeles and eat a Korean taco, you know? That's pluralism. You know, I love it that I'm not eating the same thing every day, you know, that we have cultures, I have neighbors that are all... That's a beautiful thing. But if we are just one part of the pluralism and we just brand one culture, then all we are is novelties and curiosities. But the question we have to ask and we have to wrestle with ourselves is the gospel actually true? And is God's word actually true? Is the Bible actually true? Is Jesus Christ actually real? Is it true? Because if it is true, then we have to conform to truth, because truth by definition is exclusive, and truth by definition doesn't bend for people's preferences. It is true. Truth is not a bad thing. It's a good thing because it gives us something that we can build on that will not shake and won't crumble. Preferences crumble. Feelings crumble. Truth doesn't crumble. It's something that you build upon. It's a positive thing. It's not meant to be a sword that you lop people's heads off with. It's meant to be a comfort, that there's a place in the sea and the rolling billows of the oceans of life that you know, it's hard to get your feet settled in, and you start getting seasick in life. And there's a place called truth that is actually tender. It's actually loving. It's actually helpful. It's a haven. It's a place you can go to now that you can put your feet on solid ground and it won't let you down. And if that is real, the test that most people out there will look at is to see who it is that's giving that to me and whether it's working for them. And if we're saying this, and this about this, and this, and we're living this, and this about that like that, then it's a disparate lifestyle. There's a big disconnect. Then you know, it doesn't work that we're going to go ahead and throw these great arguments out there when those arguments aren't even enough to convince us to even change our lives and to modify our lives. And so that's why I've been going the direction I've been going, because now a lot of us, we see the way people live life and the way we live life, and we kind of judge it by egregious types of sins and egregious decisions. But I'm going deeper than that. I'm going to where the nice people live, where the moral people live, where we good citizens live. And I'm saying if it doesn't change the way we live, it's impotent. And then the Christianity we're purveying is impotent Christianity, which is in itself an oxymoron. So I've been trying to kind of get us through the blog and through the message to try to challenge and think where we're at here, because I think that's where it starts. And so as we get to the issues, I don't really want to get there that fast, because the issue really isn't the issues. The issue is really us. And so, the issue of who and what we are really loyal to is what people are going to really gather. And if people were to look at your lives, and people who have a opportunity to see you at close distance and for a period of time, will they get a sense of what means most to you? Will they get a sense of what truth is and where your feet are planted? Do they know what God smells like or sounds like? Do they get a feeling of his character and his personality by engaging with you? Do people know God a little bit more because they've been with you? Over time, all that really shows up. And a lot of times we put our doing behind our being, and what we're really about is really going to emerge in the long run. And that's why, I admire people who have been proactively working in one place while getting better, staying true in long-term relationships that have been growing, who have been at their craft a long time, are still excited about it, still see their craft as novel. Why do I appreciate people like that? Because being at a place long enough, being with a person long enough, being with a friend group long enough, puts us in a position of vulnerability. It's just easier to kind of move. You can be really impressive real quick, and you can kind of give the impression real quick, but you start staying with somebody for a long time, they start to get to know you, and they start getting to know what you are and what you aren't. And it really puts the challenge and onus on you to really keep growing as a person, because if you don't, it's not going to be too long before you get really boring to people, because there's not that much to you after you've exhausted your 2 years of schmooze, right? And so it puts them in a position of vulnerability and transparencies, because people can really see what you're made of if they get to see you over time. It's hard to hide over long periods of time. And with today's penchant increasingly in demand for novelty and all things short, short texts, short tweets, short videos, short posts, short studies, short messages, short stays at jobs, short terms of service in ministry, short relationships, etc., etc., it's really common and it's really easy to not only get the short version of people's lives, but also to give the short version of your own life. As we keep hopping around, garnering new experiences with new people and new teams and new, you know, whatever we do. And so what is it that I'm getting at? What I'm really getting at is this. I've always told people that Satan's vocabulary, one of his favorite words, is always short, immediate, quick, fast. His vocabulary always tries to get you things quicker, in the shorter term, instant, towards cutting corners, always tries to push you towards getting things sooner, while God's language happens to tend to be longer, towards faithfulness, towards patience, towards persistence and perseverance and commitment and pursuing and you know, things like that. I use the word loyalty quite a bit, but loyalty almost inherently is something long-term. And I believe Satan's strategy, guys, as you look at your culture, look at my culture, we look at our culture together, I believe Satan is trying to make a move and trying to make a push towards moving the culture more and more towards mobility, towards novelty, towards new opportunities. In fact, that's been his ploy all throughout the history of man, right from the beginning at the garden, isn't it? Hasn't it been? Right in the beginning. I think he wants to build a nagging annoyance at things, at people, at processes that are slow and that take time. And things that anchor one to yesterday and to the foundations of life. He's trying to uproot us from the foundations and get us to look at it and point to us some facts that we kind of know. One of the facts about foundations is this. Foundations aren't sexy. You ever look at a foundation of a house or a foundation of playing piano or your foundation at the, you know, the foundations aren't sexy. They're a grind. They're ugly and they're frustrating, right? Why do you want to mess with the foundations? You want to, you know, go and do the fun stuff, the exciting stuff. But you know, the foundations are indispensable to long-term sustainable success in everything in life. And so what this pervasive pro-LGBT sentiment that we've been experiencing, particularly as of late in the last couple of years, it's been really just swelling a pro-LGBT culture. But what that illustrates to me is that we are tired of what is right and good. We've been there, we've done that, superficially we've done it. Now we want to try to move somewhere. We want to try more superficially. So superficial monogamous marriage-based heterosexual societies that stayed superficial in their thinking, and superficial in their values, and superficial in their commitments, superficially committed to traditional marriages, well, once you do anything superficial, it gets boring. Really, you know, after a while, it gets boring. Anything done superficially is, after a while, boring. And I think traditional marriage, if that's what we're trying to fight for, I'm trying to fight for something bigger than that, because traditional marriage, if all it means is a man, a male, you know, who's anatomically different than a female, put them together, stick a ring, make some vows, and that's marriage. That's not marriage. That's just like marriage. You know, that's marriage. It's not marriage, right? And if we keep fighting for that, you know, our goal isn't to make LGBT friends heterosexual. That's not the goal. The goal, like it is for anyone, is to introduce them to the inventor and the author of love, of what love really is, looks like and experiences. Then you don't even have to say all that much once they get to meet him. They can deal with him, but he knows what he's doing. And it's good. And so traditional marriages became boring, I think. This is my own prognosis here. Producing the need to experiment. And producing the proclivity to cheat on your spouse because being with the same partner for 40 plus years is kind of boring, some think. Because again, they were superficial and didn't delve deep into the soul, which is limitless, because we're made in a limitless, you know, in the image of a limitless God. But if you're basing it, you know, squarely on superficial, external, sexual experiences, yeah, it's going to pretty quickly. If there's no other dimension and no other depth to that sexual encounter than what animals do, then yeah, maybe someone else has something more novel. And so we cheat on spouses for novelty and excitement. And then you had the free love, the open marriage ideas, you know, decades and decades ago. And then we say, oh, but that's kind of not cool. It's not culturally accepted in our society. So let's assuage the guilt of it by challenging the root and the rule of thumb of it in the first place. Who ever said that this is what marriage is really supposed to be like? Isn't it just because most people agree to it that way? And then most people don't really know how to answer that. Oh, well, you know, that's the way it is, because that's the way it is. And then we base our, well, then why don't you think that the gay, you know, a gay lifestyle is appropriate? And then the reaction is, ew. And so ew becomes the biggest argument we have. That's disgusting. But that's not a real argument. Ew is not an argument. Because what happens when ew, there's enough, like, rebuffing of the ew, and then you kind of get yourself put in place and it's not as ew anymore. But that's pretty much been the argument for us, or for people, towards, you know, besides the obvious that that's where the tools fit. I mean, it's you know, but that's what happens. So the challenging is there. And then heterosexual novelty started becoming more commonplace and less exciting. And then on a more widespread basis, let's experiment with our own gender. And then let's assuage the guilt of that by challenging the roots again. Who says it's wrong? You know, why not? If it's about love, then isn't love the thing that matters? And we love each other. Let's get the thrill of tearing down the old foundations. So in our lifetimes, I believe we're going to see this thing get worked out further and further. And I think in your lifetimes, you're going to see more new sexual and relational novelties being played out. And I believe, this is just my own belief, I believe the LGBT novelty is going to wear out as well. And then we're going to be fighting, what? No, LGBT was bad enough. But that, oh, and then I think that's where I think you're going to see it a couple times in your lifetime. Until the anchor and the root get really fleshed out. And if it isn't, if the only reason why some of these other lifestyles are now prohibited because we kind of think they're gross, you can bet there are people pushing it to where someday it won't be gross. And if that's our reasoning, then that's coming down the pike. Is there any inherent root, inherent rightness in certain things? Is there any truth? And so that has to do with us, because how are we going to engage? How are we going to quote-unquote fight, but not fight them, but fight wrongness out there? So despite our pursuits for stuff and our experiences and novelties out there, we have to know that the greatest novelty lies in discovering all that is within the soul. Because when we continue to pursue the next novelty out there, it gets tired. And the iPhone 6 or whatever we're on now, 6S or whatever, it's not too long before the news comes out, seven's coming, and it's bam, and the 6 doesn't look quite as good. There's a perpetual need for newness. That's just inherent within us. But if we're always pursuing the newness out there, and in lifestyle, and in circumstance, and everything like that, we'll never get satiated. But there is something that lies within the soul of a human being that actually is limitless. You can discover a lot and you won't get tired. if you bother to stay long enough to peruse and dig and sweat it out. And that's part of what God meant when he said that he put eternity into the heart of man. That there is something within each person, heterosexual, same sex, whatever, tall, short, you know, left or right. There are things within each of us that are bear his image, that bear eternal things, that bespeak a God who is eternal, and eternal is limitless. Eternity, and that's a long time. And of course, he's not talking so much about time as he is about a state and a depth of being of God-likeness. And so, there's something built into the soul that longs to be committed to. You all have it, I have it. There is something within us that yearns for somebody to be loyal to us, to commit to us. There's a security that we have, to not be left, to not be ditched, that longs to be sacrificed for, that, you know, that longs to experience loyalty and love. And why do we have that in each one of us? It's because God himself, true life himself, God, longs for the same things. And we're made in his image. And so, what I just want to kind of get at is that this is kind of a taking a more foundational look, approach to addressing the LGBT issue, but not so head on the surface level, but kind of getting underneath it. And if you can understand it and know it better, you'll be able, when you navigate and have your conversations and engage in your relationships and have lunch with and play with your friends, that you'll have a better handle of what's really going on and then be able to more skillfully continue to stay in the game for the chance to one day introduce them to the one who loves them more than anyone. They just don't know it. And that might come through us. So the whole LGBT issue is really about who we are and who God is. And who we're going to be loyal and committed to, and who we're and what we're going to be committed about. Are we going to be loyal and committed to us or to him? Our desires or his desires? Our ways or his ways? Our plans and our mapping out of our future or his story and his plans for the world and that we're going to go ahead and plug ourselves into? See, when Christians are not loyal to God's master plan and to our neighbors, but instead we exhibit a penchant for fulfilling our own trajectory and our own dreams, at the diminishing of what God values and how he's laid life out. And how do we do that? We do it by desiring comfort, by desiring success, by desiring our personal fulfillment, over desiring godliness. And I didn't say prudishness, and I didn't say overconfidence. I said being like God, desiring his attributes to reign. When we desire these things over godliness, when we're not wide-eyed and drool hanging from our lips at him, and we don't have a desirous devotion to be committed to loving people for the long haul, then you know what this tells people when we don't live like that? It tells people that we too need more novelty. We too need the newness. We too need the latest. We too need more. And what we're also saying is that God's ways and God's person and God, what God has given are not really the best. That he really isn't all that satisfying actually. And that he might hold the power and authority, and thus because he's the guy in charge and he has the most power, we will dutifully get in line so we don't get punished. But what we're also saying is that he really doesn't understand the needs of our souls. He really isn't in touch. He's holding back on us. So we've got to go get it for ourselves. Which is really the same thing they're doing, isn't it? We're just doing it in a Christian way. But it's really the same thing. And that's why I say we stay with the rhetoric thing. It's just going to be pluralism. Let me just give a quick Any NBA basketball fans here? I got a brother right here, I know that. Anybody else? Is it just me and Josh? Yeah? All right. Any more? Any basketball fans? Okay, if you're like me, the last few seasons have been difficult to stomach. Our beloved LA Lakers, the most storied franchise in NBA history, have been in the dumps. And you know what? This is the most desirable place to play basketball. The most history, the most second most championships. But you know what? The last few years, we cannot, for the life of us, lure a top-flight basketball player to LA. We can't do it. And that is unprecedented. Because in history, anytime LA comes calling, you're there. Because this is LA. This is LA. Nobody wants to come. Which is weird. We had, who was at the time the best center in the league, this dude named Dwight Howard. And when he was given the opportunity to re-up with the Lakers, he bolted for less money than the Lakers would give him. He said, I'm out of here. And then every year they're trying to get somebody. This year they thought for sure they were going to lure, because there were a lot of free agents available, big name free agents. They were for sure going to get one of them. And so they put all their money in place and courted them, and none of them came. Not a one. Nada. Zilch. Zero. Nil. Not one came. And you're thinking, what is going on here? One guy they courted, they brought him, they did such a poor job the first time selling him that they asked for a second one, and he graciously granted them a second meeting, which they don't usually do. And then he said no. Now, I hate to say this, but what's one reason, and you and I hate to admit it, but what's one big reason we can't get anybody? No. There's a lot of other teams that do too. But there's a reason. But, you know, in LA, they want... Okay, he said it. That's Los Angeles blasphemy. But he said the truth, and I hate to admit it. I hate to admit it, because I don't like to admit it. But Kobe Bryant has made it very difficult for the Lakers to get any talent around here. Partly because of the way he's treated his teammates in the past and the way he treats his teammates. And it's a certain attitude. He's won 5 championships. I honestly believe it could have been 6 or 7 or more, or 8, if somehow the attitudes would mesh together when he and Shaq were here together. But they couldn't do it. And, he's the highest paid player in the NBA, even though he hasn't played for 2 years, because he keeps getting injured. And yet, you know, a reporter asked him about the possibility of maybe lowering his salary, approaching the Lakers to lower his salary, so maybe they can get, because he himself is hogging up over a third of the whole team's salary by himself. And so, would you maybe consider that to get more players in, like other players have? He scoffed at it and laughed. He says, heck no. No way I'm doing something like that. You know, and then... When they were meeting with Dwight Howard, the best center in the league at the time, about him, you know, staying on with the Lakers, and Kobe was there at the meeting, he made sure to tell Dwight, he says, I eat first. He said, you eat after I do. So Dwight says, he's out of there. You know, and so I hate to do this because I don't even like this team, but I have to admire them. You know which team I'm going towards? Okay. The team that made out the best this year in the free agency period. It's a team that everyone wants to play for. It's the San Antonio Spurs, where all free agents want to go to that team. There's a guy who was standing to make $12.5 million this year, and he left the $12.5 million to play for them at $1.5 million. Because he wanted to be part of the Spurs so much. What is it over there that people want to play? They are considered the model franchise in the league. What every team wants to aspire to be. In fact, Golden State's success was patterned after them going after the model that San Antonio put together. Well, who set the standard in this generation for that is a guy named by the name of Tim Duncan, who was one of the best players in the league and one of the best players ever, but who came to the team and told them, I want to reduce my salary kind of like in half so we can keep the great players that we have and we can get a couple more so we can build that. whose others first, team first attitude was infectious. And that's a team where everybody, they're noted for sharing the ball, that there's no real superstar, that everybody's trying to make each other a star. Now, where did Tim Duncan get an idea like that? Superstars don't think like that. Well, he got that idea because he experienced it himself. When he came into the league, there was a superstar already on the team that people were wondering if they would be able to coexist, because Shaq and Kobe barely coexisted and then imploded. And you can't have two superstars on a team. But the superstar that was in wait said, I want him, I want Tim, welcome, and I will help, I'll bring you and I'll put you up, I'll tutor you, and his name was David Robinson. David Robinson set the tone when Tim Duncan came, and due to his convictions and his faith as a Christian, and due to him understanding the value of commitment, and he delayed his NBA debut for 2 years in duty to his country because he was at the Navy, and he wanted to fulfill his commitment. And I believe the Navy even was going to consider giving him an out early since he could go to the NBA, but you know, I'm committed. He learned honor, he learned sacrifice for the greater good. So, just listen to this, just part of this article, and it's only sports, but I want you to translate it into life. Just as a young, healthy player, David Robinson was the best pivot center of his generation and one of the most statistically dominant players of any generation. Quadruple doubles are the we're waiting to see stuff of LeBron James. 70-point outings are Kobe-esque, and he's done both. Imagine that LeBron James finishes the season this year with a stat line of 30 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, two steals, and 3 blocks on average. Imagine that for a moment, that LeBron puts a quadruple double up in February and then a couple months later finishes the season with a 71-point game. That's what David Robinson did. He was a world-beating leader of men. He was an elite statistical giant of never-before-seen athleticism and a penchant for prayer. There was a period of about 3 years, this is written by a non-Christian, by the way, when I wanted nothing more than for him to retire. I couldn't understand watching him labor under a failing body, why he continued to play under, other than to honor a contract. He was the very best kind of basketball player, one who had loftier aspirations in life than playing basketball. He was a happy man with a lovely family and plenty of purposeful pursuits to fill his time. But I was naive. David Robinson's most meaningful seasons were his last seasons. Those seasons wherein, in his middle to late 30s, he still was able to drape a double-double and was a thick defensive presence over his 36-minute average per game, meaning he was still a stud. Those seemed like numbers of a mere mortal to me compared to what he's done in the past, but before I understood that most men write statistical greatness into the sand only to see it vanish with the next tide of headlines. Despite a stranglehold on historians and history books, statistical measures are fleeting. There's something more transcendent about David Robinson's final years than his earlier ones. Something that we continue to feel in every Spurs game that we watch. Because David Robinson did more for the Spurs as a role-playing complement to Tim Duncan than he did as the MVP scoring champion that he was. His greatness was lost in the late career half-life, but his willingness to stand within it, dimmed and diminished, allowed the current Spurs dynasty that they have to emerge. He's the guy. They never won a championship prior, so he came and set the tone and put the seeds in place for a long, dynasty that they have. That simple evangelical bumpkin, which is him, and his ethos of last shall be first, which David Robinson adopted in his career, helped motor the Spurs toward their dynastic accomplishments. He transformed himself from statistical colossus to a player exemplar in the seamless space of one season. And he just keeps going on everything that they're looking on. Boom, they can see David Robinson behind it and the example that he set and the culture that he started there. And then when they're at the end, he closes the article by saying, everyone knew that there was too much David Robinson in these Spurs for the rest of the Spurs to argue about playing time and stuff like that. This season, in the summer, one of the biggest free agents on the market was a guy named LaMarcus Aldridge, who came to L.A. twice to visit. And he met Kobe. And then he went to the Spurs and the culture there. And he met with them and Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan said, you know, you're great, exactly the kind of player that can fill my shoes. And if you come over, I'll tutor and mentor you, and you can come and you'll take my place. And I'll do everything that David Robinson did for me, and I'll do to you. And so LaMarcus Aldridge signs with the San Antonio Spurs. The general manager of the Spurs, in talking about this the whole summer, says, I think our guys knocked it out of the park for not having a presentation, because the Lakers had a presentation of how good LA is and how this and how. But I think the guys knocked it out of the park. I mean, they just had an environment that allowed him to understand who we are, who we were, how we do things, why we do things, what it is that we hope to build. It's not like we made something up or came up with a new magic pill. It's just being who we are. You know, that life is bigger than me attitude, that Christian loyalty and Christian character that was sown by David Robinson and passed on to Tim Duncan, who gladly mentored and tutored, you know, who he gladly mentored and tutored rather than competed with, has turned the Spurs into 5-time champs and the most desired franchise to play for because of their selflessness, team first, no room for egos culture. And that's uncommon in sports where egos are so high among the greats. And it changed the Spurs culture and the Spurs destiny. And that's what loyal, selfless, Christ-emulating living does. And this is just a secular thing called sports. But you put a Christian who's really committed in there, and it can change every venue, every culture, every environment that they're placed in. Because it leaves people scratching their heads and it gives the Spirit something to work with. I'll give you another thought here. And I don't even know if I'm going to where I was going to go, but it's okay. I'm just praying the whole time in which direction, because I have 2 different directions that I wanted to merge, but we'll see how this works. Sandra and I received an email from Johnny Erickson Tata yesterday asking for prayer. Oh, a couple of items, but one of them was asking for prayer. As she's flying out today, we got an email today just before she was leaving and stuff, and she's packing to go on her trip. And she's leaving today to Wheaton, Illinois, because she was asked to give the message at the memorial service of Titan of the Faith, Elizabeth Elliot. And if you haven't read or heard or anything about Elizabeth Elliot, look her up. Read her books. They will impact you. So Johnny sent over the program that will be given that day at the memorial service. It'll be handed out there on the campus of Wheaton College. Wheaton College, where she met her future husband, Jim Elliot. Elizabeth Elliot, which wasn't Elizabeth Elliot at that, she was Elizabeth Howard. She studied classical Greek in college. Who in their right mind would spend all that money to go to college just to study and major in classical Greek? What a waste! That's not practical. How do you get a job doing classical Greek? What are you going to do? You know, like pitas or, you know, gyros? I mean, what do you do with classical Greek? But she had a higher idea. She was living life more than practically, because that's the way we live, and that's too often the conversation. That's too often the way you and I think, right? But she wanted to study classical Greek, but she was kind of absorbed in a bigger story, in a bigger picture. And you know, when a general has a master plan in place, there's a strategy involved. And the strategy in taking over certain lands and you know, defending territory, you've got to have different people in different locales. You've got to have them there, and you've got to have them faithful to make sure that they defend their area well, because if they don't, then someone else has to cover, and if they have to cover, then they leave their posts, right? And you can't have that. Everybody has to be spot on and doing their job. Now, no one guy is going to be the big deal, but every person is so important to do their job. Because you get one hole and the enemy finds it, then that can compromise the whole mission. You've got to be faithful to your calling and your assignment. If you got people, yo, Clara, why are we in this bunker? That one is just so, why did they get to be over there? What did they do? Don't we deserve to be over there? What is that? You know, and it's like you get stuff and thinking and wondering, oh. But look at where Vince is sitting. Man, I'd love to be on his shoes, wouldn't you? You know, and you're not thinking about your mission. You're thinking just about horizontal, sideways things. You don't get the job done. Elizabeth Howard was thinking of the big plan. You sacrifice yourself. You sacrifice to be faithful, to have a chance to defend your territory. And she thought, you know, studying classical Greek was the best tool I can think of to help me translate the New Testament into some unknown language. Because God's love reaches the world. And there are some people in the world that don't have access to His Word, which we know, any of you who have had access to His Word, it's life. And some people need life. Can you imagine going to college for this? So she knew that her life was just part of God's story, which is the story. And she thought in terms of how she could highlight not only the grandeur of the greatest story of all time, but how she could highlight its author. And then she and Jim Elliot went to Ecuador separately on missions. And, you know, they actually met up there again, and they had met at Wheaton, but they both wanted to work with the Indians there, and they end up collaborating, and they end up getting married there. And while trying to make contact with previously unevangelized Aucca, well, now it's called Waudani, but back then it was called the Aucca, A-U-C-A, Indians, Jim and a few other missionaries were ambushed and murdered, cold-blooded murdered. Just, and their plane and everything, they were attacked and ambushed and murdered cold blood. Elizabeth and her 10-month-old daughter were held captive by the tribes, in which later Elizabeth said it was one of the most aggressive, fierce tribes that she had seen. They were like savages, she said. But when released, and she could go, she decided to remain there at that tribe with her daughter. And they stayed there. And her daughter actually started to learn the Aucca language faster than she did. And their pursuit to translate the Bible into the Aucca language. She decided to remain there as a missionary to the tribe that killed her husband. Her loyalty to them and her loyalty to the mission of Christ spoke loudly. And experiencing a grace and forgiveness that they had never known, the tribe eventually came to the Lord, including the man who murdered Jim. And they formed worship services and, you know, taught them, you know, how to honor God and how to communicate and you know, highlight Jesus and whatnot. And she believed that men should be the leaders of the church, so she would have to teach the men how to teach the Bible and preach, because she didn't really want to do it in front of, she wanted to teach them to go do it. Now, I don't know how many of us will be called to situations like that or circumstances like that, but I want you to know that you Christians are called to that kind of commitment. We are all called to fulfilling the bigger story. And we have to be willing to sacrifice and say no to opportunities, say no to things, say no to be able to say yes to things bigger. Because you can't say yes to everything. Because you say yes to enough things, you're saying no to some things. A yes to one thing is a no to another thing. It's just which one. And our prayers need to be thinking, our thoughts need to be thinking of, hey, I'm stationed here. There are these people in my life for a reason, you know. And you got to be thinking. I'm not saying every time you go to stay or every time you got to go, but I'm saying those are the ways of thinking that you have to consider seriously, because Christians are called to that kind of commitment, to fulfill a calling from God that is far more important and far more strategic in the world landscape than us looking at the menu of items of life and then deciding what we want to do next, which is the way we do it, right? And we can't if we're going to actually be effective in our witness. We are missionaries here. We are missionaries. If you are a Christian, you are a missionary. This world isn't your home. You are on the job. And 3/4 of this group just came back from missions this past week. And I sure hope none of you were looking to upgrade your position. I mean, you know, I hope you guys were just, you were focused on your mission. That the other things that normally plague you in life didn't matter. That you didn't think about those things. And that's why Jesus says, don't worry about whether what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink. And that's all the things we do worry about, just in other ways. Because you're on mission. And he's saying your life is a mission. And if you think this is home, so now you're looking at how to set up the furniture of your life and how to set yourself up for that future room expansion in your life in the future, and you're setting yourself for all of that, you're making it like this is home or something. And that's completely antithetical to the way Jesus lived his mission on earth, correct? Where he couldn't even, didn't have a place to lay his head, they said. Because he knew this wasn't his home. And neither is it yours. And neither is it mine. And I just say, consider what God's calling for you might be. And not God's calling for you, but consider how this would fulfill the story that God is writing. And how it would make sense to the people who know you. And I would encourage you, for as much as you're able to, as much as you know, God is calling you to stay at a place long enough, stay with people long enough, to where you can actually be trusted. And it takes time to build trust, where you can actually be relied upon, where you actually can be valued and known. I sat with a man who's a missionary to Muslims last week, and he was explaining to me the strategy of, there's no way Christians are going to reach them unless they're willing to get into their lives, into their world, befriend them, invite them over for dinner, and do life with them for a number of years. I told you last time I taught here, 7 years is the minimum. Because they are still wondering if they can trust you, and you have to build that, and you have to earn it. And then he kind of was flabbergasted at how a lot of Christians go to the Muslims and try to convert them right on the spot. They don't even know their culture. They don't even know, you know, and kind of convert them with a tract. He said there are Christians still passing tracts out to them and stuff. You know, now he might be overstating it a little bit, or I don't know, but I'm just saying, I know that generally speaking, unless your life is a walking miracle, or where miracles happen all the time, that more people need to see that miracle because something just explosively happens, then maybe if your life isn't that quick miracle and it's a slow miracle, then you need to give them the opportunity to see that miracle forming and evolving and take place. Otherwise, it just sounds and smells. I mean, there's just really nothing that much different. And I don't think I'm going to get to the being doing today, but maybe this will work. So a big problem in our day that I just want you to put in your back of your mind, so when you're making your decisions and all that kind of stuff going forward, it isn't about you. But just be careful to not be the Christian that's jumping around from one place to another, one church to another, one friend to another, one ministry to another, one cause to another, one job to another, one this to another, you know, which is just a cleaned up version of worldliness at its core. It's like, I want more. What's next? What's next? What's next? Unless there's something, you know, major that's a calling. And then that's cool. That's fine. It's not the thing itself. It's the reasons behind it. And that's what I'm asking you to really check. What are the reasons? If there are reasons, maybe it's just, I need something new. But that's what I'm saying. Because it communicates a commitment to ourselves, and that kind of Christian church falls short for a lot of people. And that's kind of just like normal. Let me read this story, just a real quick one. But you know, Francis Chan, in his second book, Forgotten God, relays the story, and I've read it here before, so you might be familiar. But you know, he founded Cornerstone Community Church, and after, I forget how many years it was, 15 something, 18 years, it was becoming too He loves the church. He founded it, became thousands of members and everything, but it started getting too big, too cushy for him, and it started kind of feeling more corporate and farther from kind of the Christian way of living. So he's in San Francisco now, kind of at the Skid Row type of areas and back to the small stuff. But while he was at this church, he said, a while back, a former gang member came to our church. And he was heavily tattooed, and he was really rough around the edges. But he was curious to see what church was like. He had a relationship with Jesus, and he seemed to get fairly involved with the church. After a few months, I found out that the guy was no longer coming to our church. When I asked why he didn't come anymore, he gave the following explanation. I had the wrong idea of what church was going to be like. I mean, when I joined the church, I thought it was going to be like joining a gang. Because you see, in the gangs, we weren't just nice to each other once a week. We were family, man. And then Francis Chan writes, that killed me. Because I knew that what he expected is what church is intended to be. And it saddened me to think that a gang could paint a better picture of commitment, loyalty, and family than the local church body could. You see, the church is intended to be a beautiful place of community. And that's why I said last time, as we are trying to share God with our friends, LGBT included, there's got to be a place that, I mean, we are inviting them to a family. And what is the family like? A place where wealth is shared. When one suffers, everyone suffers. When one rejoices, everyone rejoices. A place where everyone experiences real love and acceptance in the midst of great honesty about our brokenness. And most of the time, this isn't even close to how we would describe our churches. Without the Spirit of God in our midst, working in us, guiding us, and living and loving through us, we're never going to be the kind of people who make up this kind of community. There's just no such thing as a real believer who doesn't have the Holy Spirit, and there's no such thing as a real church without the Spirit. It's just not possible. But what is possible is that we would individually and corporately quench and hinder the Spirit's activity in and through our lives. So as for me, I'm tired of talking about what we're going to do. Sick about talking about helping people, sick of brainstorming and conferencing about ways we can be radical and make sacrifices. I don't want to talk anymore. Life's too short. I don't want to just speak about Jesus. I want to know Jesus. And I want to be Jesus to people. I don't want to just write about the Holy Spirit. I want to experience His presence in my life in a profound way. So a few months ago, the elders at Cornerstone Church began to ask the question, why don't we live like the believers who made up the first church? In Acts 2:42-47, we read the following, and I read this for you last time. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread, to prayer. Devoted is a huge word, by the way. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All of the believers were together, had everything in common. They sold property, sold possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And what happened was that the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. And what followed was a beautiful time of sharing as our elders laid everything at one another's feet. We surrendered the keys to our cars, into our homes, into our bank accounts. The elders looked me in the eyes and said, what's mine is yours. If anything ever happens to you, I will support and care for your kids as much as I would care for my own. I'll be your life insurance. And because they had a history of genuine sacrifice for the sake of the gospel, I believed what they said. From there, we began going to some of our friends in the congregation, expressing our commitment to them. And now this mentality is spreading. New life is permeating the church as individuals back up their words with sacrifice. Cars and homes are being sold or given away. Expensive vacations are joyfully replaced with caring for others. People are being welcomed into others' homes, not only for meals, but to live. This is a small example of the kinds of things that happen when people start to walk with the Spirit and ask the Holy Spirit to affect every part of their lives. I just shared about what a few people in one church, in one city, in one country are doing. What else might it look like when people begin to walk with the Spirit, submitting everything to Him? Just dream a little with me. This will look different in various cultures around the world, but the Spirit will lead believers in Beijing to do different things from believers in the United Kingdom or the believers in Argentina. But it's just a hint of what happens when we begin to actually live like we need the Spirit. There's more, but you know, it's a great read. I'm just not telling us what to do. I'm just trying to give us some thoughts, some pictures of what needs to precede the presentation, what needs to precede the arguing, and that life has to be the argument. You know, they can say, you know, I don't know if I agree with what you're saying, Brian, but inside, but I can't argue with your life, and I can't argue with the way you've cared for me. I can't argue with that. I can't argue with your commitment and your honesty. I can't argue, but I'm still arguing with what you're saying. I don't know if I agree with that, but at least you're halfway home, right? Guys, if our Christianity isn't lived in a way that makes it hard to explain why we do what we do, or why we make the godly self-sacrificial choices that we make, that leaves people wondering in disbelief, or some disbelief at least, what exactly are we being a witness to then? We're certainly not saying God is worth it all because we're not willing to give it all. And what people will take is God is only worth what you're willing to give up for Him. And I be very, very careful with this. I don't mean legalistically, performance-based, earning anything. I'm not saying that at all. I'm actually advocating that you kind of stop the distractions in your life for, you know, just kind of put them somewhere a little bit. Take a vacation and discover for yourself, wrestle, fight, pray. Pray that God would reveal Himself to you in a way. Pray that God would open, you know, your heart and remove the scales from your eyes. Pray that the calluses that you no longer can feel things on, that He can kind of gently remove them so you can feel again. You know, pray these things kind of on your own accord. Get with people who are committed to doing likewise and similarly. And see if you can't just taste and see that He's good. And as you do, I know you guys, you will have absolutely no problem sharing with someone something that you're so excited about and can't. There's nobody here who can't give a great apologetic for their favorite restaurant or for their favorite sport or their player. You know, who's better, this team or this team? And immediately, yeah, no, and then you can give the whole apologetic convincingly and it makes sense. And you guys don't have a problem with technique. You have a problem with belief and actually experiencing and believing that is true. And we can't give people what we don't have if we've never really experienced God in His vibrancy. And I ask you to just go home and get on your knees and say, God, you know, I've never experienced what it's like to actually commune with You. And I've been at church for so long and I know I'm supposed to. And how come other people feel it and I don't? And so if you're there, could you, I, what do you want from me? And just have some heart-to-heart down dirty, just some real time. But you got to come ready to, you can't come, you know, with leverage and saying, you know, holding something, you can have that, but you've got to come. But you know that He's faithful. You know that He's true. And if you seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, all these things are going to be added to you. Those are all true things. But you've never experienced it because you can't let go. And if you can't let go, you can't get there. And sure, you might be a couple inches farther than your friend who's still stuck here, but if you ain't letting go, you're not getting through the gates of splendor. Christian equation is a life for a life. His life for yours. And he gave it. Full risk and all, he gave it. And he let go. And the only way you're getting through those gates and to that life and to that experience and that vibrant, and then, you know, on the, it's almost like Aladdin's carpet. I mean, it's just like, this is the whole, when he's at the wheel, it's like scary because it's like, who's driving this thing? It's him. And life just changes. And then you have an amazing ability. Every one of you here has an amazing ability to advocate for something. This is so good. And you don't need lessons, and we don't need TD meetings to tell you how to be excited about something that you're already excited about. But if you can't do that, it's just because you haven't tasted, you haven't experienced. You have, and I'm not condemning you for that. I'm just saying, hey, let's go for it. Let's go for it. And if you kind of take the summer and kind of wrestle and do business with God, just get on your face if you have to, you know. Just get on your face, get on your knees. You know, just try it. Just forget your pride. And if the song that you're singing says, I lift my hands, just do it. I know it's not, you know, conservative or whatever, but if you're saying it, do it. You know, I'm on my knees, and, you know, some of you always see Sandra, she ends at some point in some worship session, you always find her on her knees somewhere because the song says, you know, I bow my knee to you, whatever. You know, just discover God. And if you do, and if you get real, and you get honest, and you study, it takes sweat. You got to roll up your sleeves. You got to study. You got to apply your skills in OCHEM or biology or whatever, or economics. You got to apply the skills you learned that in statistics, Caleb, or wherever it is. I don't even know where Caleb. Well, there's Caleb. You got to apply the skills you learned there so you can discover God more and apply it to studying the Word. The more skill you gain out there in everything that you're studying and doing, the more you can come back and actually understand and not only understand, but drool at His Word more. You'll actually hear His Word better. Hear His Word, and it's just, and the voice will have overtones, and it will be ringing, and it will be just like, wow. And you'll start to fight for it, but eventually you'll get it. And then you'll get up from a Bible study, kind of sweating, and feeling like, you know, Jacob would wrestle with the angel, you know, and you're just like, wow. God takes you, and bam, He throws you to the ground, and you're like, ah, oh, wow, that was good, you know. Oh, and it's been a long time since I've been thrown to the ground that way, but that was a good. And then you can, you know, everything flows from there. And so, and then when you meet with your LGBT friends, I don't even want to call them that, because that's not who they are. And I was going to get there this today, and I'm not going to get anywhere near it. I have half the material still to go, which I'll save for next time. But let's do a friend. I don't even want to call them that anymore. I don't call my neighbor my heterosexual friend. You know, I don't call it. You know, it's just let's start giving people the dignity that they have, that they are. They're people made in God's image. Let's treat them with dignity. And let's not compromise the truth, but let's compromise our biases and prejudices in terms of just stigmatizing people. That's our nature, to stigmatize them. Let's not do that. What they believe and what they're forcing on is wrong. The court's decision was wrong. It wasn't even the right. They don't even have the right to make a decision like that. It's not even the rule of law that it was just wrong. And I'm totally 100%. That wasn't right. And it upset me that they ruled. I mean, that they practiced law on something that wasn't a legal thing. So I'm not saying it isn't wrong. It's totally wrong. And it's wrong at the core. And it will be damaging. And it will be. But I just don't know if this is going to make it right. And it's got to be done person by person. So I do value the people who are fighting and defending on that level. And that's where Nathaniel is right now. You know, and that's maybe where he's called to be on that bigger. And I'm so thankful for those guys. But the real life change happens one person at a time right here. actually believing the gospel changes your life. And if your life isn't changed and isn't going in a new direction with new sacrifice, and you don't even care about things you used to care about anymore, and you're still going to say, if that's not happening, then you've got to come back, because then what's different about your life? And the Spirit hasn't made a change. And I'm not like forcing it and saying, how come your life isn't changed? I'm just asking you to ask yourself and then come to the Lord. So, what is your calling? What is our calling? What is our mission? Acts 1:8. You'll receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you. You will be my witnesses. In Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, TC, Alhambra, whatever it is, end of the earth. But the emphasis being, you will be my witnesses. That is your calling. That is my calling. Everywhere, all the time. All the time. Do you think like that yet? Everywhere, all the time. Bar no place. And Matthew 8, 28, 18 through 20 says, Jesus came up and spoke to them. This is known as the Great Commission. All authority has been given to me, Jesus says, to me in heaven and on earth. Jesus says, I have been given, granted, all authority, cosmic authority, universal authority. And so with this authority, I say, go therefore, and I tell you to make disciples of all nations. The emphasis being on making disciples, which takes time, which takes relationship, which takes commitment, which takes perseverance, which takes frustration and overcoming, which, you know, it takes, make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And when have you ever heard the second part of this? Not that often. Teaching them to observe. This is the key. Teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. God will give to you what He can give through you. But the more He can give through you, the more He's going to give to you. And it's just like a great collaboration. And then He says this, and don't worry, guys, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. I'm always going to be. When you're doing my work, I will never not be where my work is done. And I'll never not be with who's doing my work. If you're going to have the faith, and if you're going to honor me as such, to sacrifice your own, you know, desires and your own status and your own popularity and your own everything, and you're going to do that for me? Are you kidding me? Jesus says, are you kidding me? I'm going to be with you always. There's no way I'm going to ever leave you hanging when you were out there sticking your neck out, life and limb, reputation and everything, you know, people's ridicule and everything. If you're going to do that for me, there's no way I'm not going to be with you. No way. Going to get into our groups here in just a second. But I just want to read this last passage for you, which I don't have in my notes, but it just came up. And okay, Acts chapter 7. Who's the first martyr? Stephen. I love this passage. Okay. Stephen sticks his neck out for Jesus. And he says, you men who are stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears always resisting the Holy Spirit, you're doing just what your fathers did. I mean, which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who had righteously announced the coming of the righteous one, that's Jesus, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. Now, he's just giving it to them. You who received the law as ordained by angels and yet didn't even keep it. Now, it says this in verse 54. When they heard this, they were cut to the quick. They began gnashing their teeth at him. When was the last time you got so angry, so livid that your teeth are grinding, you know? But being full of the Holy Spirit, that's the operative presence there. He gazed intently into heaven, and he saw the glory of God. And what did he see? What did he see? He says he just saw Jesus standing at the right hand of God. Where is Jesus always? What is he always doing with respect to God? Everywhere else. our Lord who sits at the right hand of God, right? Always. And Stephen sees Jesus standing at the right hand of God. Now, when you go to a court of law, and I don't know how many of you have been there, but when you go to a court of law, there's a time when everybody rises. All rise, the Honorable Sandra Shea is entering the room. You know, Judge Sandra enters the room, everybody rises, and then you may be seated. After she sits, you may be seated. And for the rest of the trial, who stands? Does a judge stand? Does a jury stand? Does a defendant stand? Who stands? The attorney, the advocate stands. And Jesus, who is called our advocate, standing at the right hand of God, advocating probably for Stephen. And he says, "Behold, I see the heavens opened up and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they cried out with a loud voice. They covered their ears and they rushed upon him with one impulse. And when they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him because they couldn't do it inside. And the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul, who later becomes Paul. The same Apostle Paul who wrote a lot of the New Testament. And then they went on stoning Stephen as he called upon the Lord and said, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." And then falling on his knees as he's being stoned, he cries out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." Does that sound familiar? Having said this, he fell asleep. When a mob was taking stones and just ouch, and that even hurt, and that's just my little ring. Jesus says, "I'm with you even to the end of your age." And his eyes are captivated because he sees something that's not seen. And his eyes, and so as he feels, Jesus holds his, and he's able to, despite all this, "Father, forgive them." He's able to rise above himself and be like Jesus. And Jesus says he will be with you even to the end of the age. The early Christians knew that. And that's why it says in Acts, they turned the world upside down with their Christianity. So this is our calling, guys, everywhere, all the time. We need to live in a way that makes it clear that life has a higher calling. We need to sacrifice our little desires so we can actually fulfill the master strategy and the master plan. And we need to have such meaningful and transcendent communion with and connection with the caller of the calling that people get a taste of them when they meet you. And so what I want you to do, just in the little time that we have left, I want you to just get back into groups. Because of our time, maybe just in pairs, that might be fine, or threes or fours, just something small like that. Just want to remind you, courtesy of John Dixon here, the mission of the church is to announce the nearness and the arrival of the kingdom in the person of Jesus Christ. That is our mission. Our church, the church is not the church unless it is caring for the needs of those around it. Good deeds promote goodwill that opens hearts to the good news. And I just want to give you our ancestors, give you a picture of our ancestors. Because in the ancient world, when the persecution was super great, the first datable international aid program in world history was the Apostle Paul's collection for the poor. The Apostle Paul, who was there receiving the robes and was witnessing Stephen's death, who became converted to Jesus Christ and his love, now actually ran the very first datable international aid project. What we also know is that by the year 250 in Rome, the persecuted church in Rome had 1,500 people on a daily food roster. They had 14 deacons assigned to the task of looking after this roster. The poverty roll of the Roman church in the year 250 was the largest association in the Roman world. It was bigger than all the unions there. By the 4th century, Emperor Julian the pagan was terrified that the Christians were going to take over the world by their good deeds. Is anyone scared of that today? And he started writing to the pagan priests, demanding that they institute a welfare system like the Christians had, so that they could beat the Christians at their own game. So he wrote to this priest, "We must pay special attention to this point," writes Emperor Julian, "and by this means we must effect a cure for the sickening advance of Christianity. For when it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the priests," that is, the pagan priests, "then I think the impious Galileans," the Christians, "observed this fact, and they devoted themselves to philanthropy. They began with their so-called love feast or hospitality or service of tables, for they have many ways of carrying it out, and hence they call it by many names. And the result is that they have led very many into this atheism." He called Christianity atheism. So whenever you hear atheism, it's Christianity. Because it denies the Greek and Roman gods. And so he wrote a letter the year before his death. In 362, he wrote this letter to Arcatius, the pagan high priest of Galatia, in which he promised millions of dollars of the imperial purse to establish a welfare system in the pagan temples modeled after the Christian one. Why do we not observe that it is the Christians' benevolence to strangers, it is their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done most to increase this atheism? It is disgraceful that these impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. Letter 22 to Arcatius. And so we see the beautiful connection between the gospel proclamation, the care for our neighbors. But what we're trying to say is that these are not competing missions. One mission is to proclaim the gospel. The one character is to love. And Dixon closes by saying, we mustn't confuse our categories. To not preach the gospel is to defy our mission. And to not care for others, especially the poor, is to defy our essence. So here's the question. Instead of looking hypothetically at ways that, you know, we can let God be displayed in our life going forward in the future, I want us to turn back and look at actual history, our history, and to learn from them. So what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to break up and answer this question. And then, you know, we can pray and then we can go upstairs. And here it is. Or some version of it, you can, you know, adapt it. What decisions, you got to have to be thoughtful about this, what decisions or choices have you made maybe in recent weeks, let's say weeks or months, whenever it is, it's fine, that you could have and should have done differently that would have been more faithful to God and would have served people better? And what I want you to do is I want you to look at this. I want you to actually go back, because it's important to debrief events, debrief missions, and debrief your life. I want you to go back and look at your life. Let's just take the last couple weeks of your life, whatever. And I want you to go and identify where you know God maybe have been nudging you to do something and you didn't. Or you did kind of certain way, make it look a certain way, but it really wasn't authentic. Or you just plain out denied the opportunity. Or you tried it, but it really wasn't done well or right or with good spirit. You know, whatever it is. But I want you to look back at the opportunities you've had in the last, whatever, a few weeks. And I want you to look back and just I'd be able to identify how that could have been done better, more authentically. Just as an idea and an exercise, so that maybe you can get in the habit of looking, and so that in the future, you can actually build and improve upon the past. Does that make sense? Okay. And then I'll let you guys close in prayer together. Okay. So everybody got the question?